forget about public school for a second and just look at like traditional education. Some private schools look mostly like public schools, but they like have slightly better facilities, or they, you know, they seem like slightly happier places. But the basic thing that they do is the same, which is, you know, there's 45-minute block classes, there's a schedule, there's a teacher in each class. The ratios are somewhere between like 1 in 15 in a really good case and 1 in 40 in a, you know, more typical case. I don't like that system, whether it's a public school or a private school. I don't think that it's good for children to spend 13 years of their lives, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, most of the year, a little bit more than half of the year, until they're 18, which is a crazy old time to stop doing that.
Hello, everyone. You are listening or watching Chatting with Candace. I am your host, Candace Horbach. Before we jump into the episode, if you have not, make sure you hit that like and subscribe button. That helps with the algorithm. It helps with notifications so that you don't miss a single episode. I'm going to do my very best to be updating every single week, but sometimes things are going to happen. Guests are going to fall through. My schedule is going to change, or maybe I just can't find the exact conversation that I want to have. So it's not going to be every single week, as I'm sure you've noticed with the last couple weeks. So it's very important that you are subscribed so that when I do post, you get notified and you can jump into some new content. This week, we have Matt Bateman joining the podcast. I have been trying to get him on the show for a little while now, and the timing of this is really perfect. He is a philosopher at the Guidepost Schools and Montessorium. He is really disrupting the space even within the Montessori programs. His approach is very different from a lot of programs that you would see out there. And as someone who is in the early stages of parenthood, education is very important to me right now, and I'm trying to figure out, what is the best education for children? Is there a universal answer? What is going to make sovereign and confident little people that have a sense of agency and think for themselves and don't cower and conform and fall to the feet of authority, but challenge it and ask curious questions? And this conversation didn't disappoint. I learned a lot. I hope that you do too. Let me know your favorite part of the podcast in the comments below. And without further ado, please help me welcome Matt Bateman. Matt, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm so excited to have you. And I feel like, so we were rescheduling and scheduling, and you had a baby and I had a baby. Yeah. And it actually works out perfect because I tend to find myself in these like little pockets of curiosity, and education has been very alive for me. And tomorrow I actually have someone from Synergy coming on as well. So you guys are back-to-back guests, which is incredible. So I just felt like with everything happening, the timing was meant to be. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh, I'm happy to join. And yeah, mine is almost 9 months old now. So almost as much time out of the womb as in the womb, which is like a milestone.
Oh yeah, for sure. You have how many kids?
Two. So the older one's 3.5, going on 40. And the younger one's still a baby, yeah.
Yeah, we're on like a very similar trajectory. My oldest is 3.5, and then my youngest is 1. So we're like neck and neck, but it's a really cool place to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think I love that you work with Montessori right now. Our oldest is in a Montessori program.
That's great.
So I guess the first question is, let's define what Montessori is supposed to be. Like, what does like a pristine Montessori program look like, and what are kind of the foundational cornerstones of their approach to education?
Yeah, I mean, the kind of very basic idea of Montessori, you'd think I could explain this more concisely given this is what I do for a living, but I'll do my best. The very basic idea is that if you prepare an environment in a certain way so that it's like very perfect for a child of a certain age, let's just take a 3-year-old, and like it's full of just the right number of materials and just the right types of materials where children can do real things and interact with them in a certain way. It's not overwhelming, it's not overstimulating, but it's also not understimulating. It's not full of things that they can't reach or don't understand. And it's full of child-sized furniture. And you have a teacher that really understands the materials in the classroom and kind of how they're supposed to be used and how to really inspire children to use them for real tasks, like really real tasks, like studying literacy or math, which 3-year-olds in Montessori classrooms do, or like making a cup of real tea, like things that you wouldn't think that a 3-year-old could do, but real things, not like, you know, having a tea party with a doll, but like a real making real tea for a guest. And then you let the child free in that environment. So it's all set up. The teacher knows what they're doing and the environment is all set up. And under those circumstances, you can give the child a tremendous amount of latitude. You can say, do what you want. And it's not like there are no boundaries. It's not like if the child decides to trash the room that the teacher will do nothing. But in those circumstances, the child will tend to want to work on something. They'll want to pick something off of a shelf that's interesting to them, or they'll want to go to the teacher and ask for an explanation of how something is used. And they will work with it, with that material. And not just for a minute, like people think of three-year-olds, oh, they'll like play with it for a minute, but for like 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, they'll really get into it and they'll concentrate and they'll lose themselves into it. They'll get into a kind of flow state. And that is the goal. I mean, that kind of getting children into that state of deep concentration is the goal of Montessori, and that's where the magic happens. So that's the basic idea. You set everything up. It's beautiful. It's perfect. You give the child a lot of freedom, and then they do this real meaningful work.
So it seems that I was actually surprised to learn that there's no official Montessori like accreditation. Like it's like almost anyone can slap it on like a toy
yep.
or a school. So you have to be really diligent as to what you're either like buying or where you're placing your kid, because there's not really anyone coming to make sure that like they're licensed to use that name, which to me seems really crazy. Is that the same for other types of like particular schools? Is it the same for like a Waldorf school or like a Socratic school? Is there, do you know anything about the licensing there, or is it the same?
It's definitely the same for Socratic, for kind of broad things like Socratic. I should know the answer to this. I'm not sure about Waldorf or Reggio. I seriously doubt they have trademarks, but they might. But yeah, Montessori is like, it's a bunch of things, but it's like, I mean, you're right. Anybody can hang up a shingle and say, we're a Montessori school, and they can have literally nothing in the school that has anything to do with Montessori, and nobody will stop them from doing that. At least in most places in the U.S., there are a couple of states that have exceptions to that. And that's the U.S., by the way. Like in Australia, like you can't just do that. Like there's like a kind of governing body that has a partnership with the actual government. It's not trademarked. And there's like in the Montessori world, we call Montessori schools that, you know, are like they suck and they're not really Montessori, but they call themselves Montessori. We call them Mono something or Mono sort of. We have pejorative terms for them. But the bottom line as a parent is that you've got to go in and judge, like, does it look anything like the things that I said it looked like? And there's like a checklist that I sometimes give parents, like what to look for. Like, is there something on the wall that's at the adult's height in a toddler classroom and that's words? You know, it's like an inspirational poster, like a quote from Montessori or something. It's like, who's that for? It's not for the child, right? So there's kind of things like that where if they're really obsessed about the environment that you won't see in a good Montessori environment.
Is there a reason that you leaned into Montessori and not something like Waldorf or not something like a Stoic program?
I used to be a philosophy professor. That's my kind of first career, and I didn't love academia, and I was kind of looking for an out, and I've worked a lot with children, including teaching at preschools. And so one of the things that I was looking at was like, do I want to get into education? And I didn't know anything about Montessori. And one of my friends showed me a Montessori school. He flew me out to California, and I saw my first Montessori classroom, and it was like a love at first sight thing for me. I've seen a lot of different kinds of preschools. I've worked in preschools, like good progressive preschools, and Montessori is just, it's different. Like you don't get that. I don't even know how to explain it. You know, like, I mean, for me as a child, I don't know what maybe you have something like this as a child. Like I got really into Legos. Like I would like work with Legos for like 2 hours, or like I'd play at the creek for like 4 hours and my parents would have to drag me back inside and eat. Like that kind of focus is in a Montessori classroom, except it's not with Legos. It's with like sandpaper letters or golden beads that teach you math, or like making yourself a snack and cutting the banana yourself or peeling the orange yourself. It's that kind of focus on real things. And I don't think you get that in other approaches, whatever other virtues they might have. I think Reggio is really good at creativity and family connections. Different approaches have different strengths. But for me, it was like the deep focus was the special thing. And I do think that that's really important and very often missing. Very, very often missing.
So you have, and I mean, I've experienced this when I go to like pick up my son, or if I come early and I get to kind of peek in at what he's doing, or the teacher will tell you what he, like his, I love that they call it their work. I don't know why. Yeah. I find it's really cute, but like what his work was that day. And it might be that he worked on like a real key and lock, and like, you know, sorting those out and figuring out what goes with what for 20, 30 an hour. And I'm like, it's really hard to see that focus in the house because the house is not set up like a Montessori classroom, right? And it could definitely be better, but it's nowhere near the setup that he has at his program. So is that kind of undoing a lot of what people are paying for when they send their child to a Montessori program and they come back to the house and it's very different? Is that like, no. Is that a problem, or is that adjusting them to the real world and different circumstances? And
I mean, it's neither. I don't know. So it's a lot of, like, you can set up your house like very Montessori way. If you ever go on Montessori TikTok, you will immediately feel terrible as a normal parent because you're like, what the hell? Like, how is this 2-year-old using a Keurig and making her parents coffee every morning? It's ridiculous things. And I think a lot of them are like actually fake and kind of weirdly edited. But mm-hmm. but you can do a lot to set up your home, but. And we do a lot at home, but we don't do nearly as much as they do in a Montessori school. So we like have a shelf for our daughter where there's like, I mean, multiple shelves, but like in the kitchen, there's a special shelf where she has her own plates and bowls and cups. And she has a paper towel roll that she can use to clean up messes. And she uses it. I mean, it's helpful to have it. She uses it a lot of the time. Is it the same kind of maniacal level of empowerment and independence that you get in a Montessori classroom? No. And she doesn't exhibit the same behaviors at home, though there's some overlap. I like paying somebody to do it for me. I mean, this is, I mean, the kind of idea of Montessori school is that you get this a few hours a day of this very intense work, as the teacher described it. And I like that term resonates with you. Does the child's entire life have to be like that? No, like they can run around, they can play, they can be silly. They can watch TV. Like it's okay. And it's good. A lot of those things are good. It's just this special period of focused work is not usually something that happens naturally unless you really try. And that's the Montessori school's job. That's how I think about it.
So you mentioned TV, which I'm so glad that you did. Yeah. Because my oldest is in his threes still, and the class that he's in, I think the youngest is 3 and then the oldest is 5 in a couple months. Mm-hmm. It's like a really big conversation that the parents are having with the teachers is, well, what do we do with technology and what do we do with screens? And it's there. It is the mass belief that it is just wrong, period. Tech is bad, period. And I feel like an outlier when I'm going to these meetings because I feel like I read a lot of the studies, and Peter Attia actually did a really great dissection of all of the current ones when it comes to screens in language development, cognitive abilities. And he was like, well, this is, as my interpretation of these studies, this is what the conclusion is. And his conclusion from those studies was there are so many competing factors as to what creates a delay in language or cognitive ability or attention deficit or things that kind of mimic that. It has to do with, like, are you engaged with the content? What kind of content? What other activities are you doing outside of TV? Are you using the TV as a nanny and just putting them in front of the TV for 3 hours, 4 hours a day and just like not really parenting? All of these things kind of contribute into all of these concerns that we have as a parent. It's not the TV. Yeah. The TV just kind of signals maybe other bad practices as parents that we might have. But rather than look at it that way, they just say, no, all tech is bad. So I guess what's your stance on technology? And then do we kind of have to supplement it if we are subscribing to a program like Montessori?
Where to start? So in the Montessori world, is you will often find people who are very technology shy, if not outright anti-technology. That's not me, and that's not us. So this is it's not a uniform view, and I don't think it would have been Maria Montessori's view. I think Montessori, there's evidence that she was like experimenting with moving images in the classroom, and the kinds of, like, she was like, what, you can get a video of an elephant for a child to see instead of just like an illustrated picture of an elephant? That's great. But putting all that aside, just what's the actual right answer here? I would go even further than you went. I would say technology is good. And I don't want my children. So my daughter is three. She's old enough to kind of absorb vibes from kind of adults about these things. I don't want my children to grow up with adults who are cynical about it. Mm-hmm. Who are like, oh, like screen time sucks or social media is destroying the world or whatever. Like if the like, oh, like, yeah, you can watch TV, but that's a bad thing for you to do. And they're kind of like, now they're getting these kind of mixed motives and mixed messages. I think the internet is good. Technology is good. Computers are good. TV is good. That doesn't mean that it's risk-free. Mm-hmm. Like there are risks to technology. I mean, and one of the major risks, like the risk of riding a bike is that you fall off and crack your skull open. The risk of watching TV is that you turn into a passive zombie and like you're just kind of using the screen as a babysitter and you're watching low value content. You got to manage those risks. Like nothing is risk free, but basically it's good. And yeah, like it shouldn't dominate, like you shouldn't have the child in front of the screens passively all the time to the point where they're not doing other things or interacting with people. That's really bad. But I agree with who's the author of the study that you mentioned?
He's not the author of the study, but he did like a mass interpretation for his newsletter. Is Dr. Peter Attia.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that I don't even think that screen time should be a concept. Like it's like screen time, like calling grandma and like binging on TikTok are not the same category of thing. Like it's not like, oh, there's screen time, and both of those things belong together because they share some essential property of being on a screen. There's nothing in common. And I don't even think that, I mean, my three-year-old loves movies and she loves narrative. She's a story. She's like a musical theater kid. And she has been since she was one. We show her Disney movies, like long movies that it's hard for a kid to pay attention to. And she doesn't really fully understand it. And she has to struggle and she has to ask a million questions. Like that's good for her. And she's very actively engaged and we'll keep kind of ramping it up the older that she gets. She watches like 30 minutes, an hour of TV every day. And I think it's a positive good for her.
Yeah, I'm in the same camp too. And we found a couple really good shows that have helped with him like understanding emotional intelligence and things like mindfulness and breathing. One of our favorites is Stillwater. I don't know if you have her watching that. It is amazing. It's a lot of like Eastern philosophy. So like there's like a lot of Zen and mindfulness.
The books. I know the books.
Okay. Yeah. It's on Apple.
That panda.
Yeah. It's great. So that's one of our favorites. So if he's in a place, we kind of like, and I think an important thing too is how many adults aren't really great at modulating like the exact dosage that we should be having of social media, for example, because it was introduced to us at a weird age and we didn't really know necessarily it can hijack your brain. So I think something that's really important for him is to understand how to calibrate that. So when is too much? Like when are my eyes glazing over? When do I start to feel like really fidgety because I've been sitting for too long? So having him like work through those like very real things. And then if he gets to this place where he's agitated, be like, well, what is your body telling you? Like, is your body telling you that maybe you did too much of your iPad or that you did too, right? So not just like making the decisions for him, which I think goes back to Montessori, which is self-sufficiency and really instilling a sense of agency into the child.
I think that that's totally true. I have not been as successful with my daughter at getting her to kind of decide to stop. She will decide to stop on her own, but often we impose limits. We're like, go outside, you know, do something else. Mm-hmm. But I've seen parents who do it. I've seen parents who like have a 2-year-old who like, they're like, we just let them play with the iPad whenever they want. And they just don't use it more than 30 minutes a day. And mm-hmm. I'm like, wow. Like, I mean, if that's the temperament of your child or that's what you succeeded in doing in terms of setting up, that's amazing. And I've talked to older children, like 8, 10, 12 year olds once the child gets a little bit older, it's not that hard to sensitize them to this kind of thing that you're talking about. And they can be very sophisticated. Like even things like, you know, like a 10-year-old boy or a 12-year-old boy who watches Dune and who also spends a lot of time on TikTok. And the next day they're like, I was thinking about Dune last night as I was falling asleep. And like, I have these questions and because Dune is this long, complex, epic story with this rich. And you're like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I have a question. Like, so you can answer the question about Dune, but I have a question. Like, do you ever think about TikToks the next day? I'm like, oh, not really. Like, I usually just kind of think about them more and then I forget about them. Oh, that's interesting. Like, that's an interesting thing to notice. So if you want something that like really stimulates your thought, you might want to watch something longer form or more complicated. Like children can be sensitized to these things. It's just like you said, it's like we haven't figured out as a society, as parents, as educators, like what is the kind of dosage? What is the language around it? How do we teach this skill to make it so that, you know, social media is a terrible servant or it's a terrible master, but an awesome servant. So like, how do we, for some people, it's a servant and it's great. And like, how do we kind of make our children see it that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was watching Matthew McConaughey just did a morning interview, and he was talking about the decision that he made for his child to get onto Instagram. And I think his kid's like 13 or 14. He's in the teenage era. And I mean, he obviously held out a lot longer than a lot of parents, but the way that he described it is, I guess he was like showing different examples of how people use it. And it's like, well, what are your intentions with this technology? And I think that's a lot of it, is understanding how to use it. Like, you can use it to create like just like more more dispersed and decentralized information, right? Like, now you see independent journalism taking off, which is incredible. You see people starting their own schools, which you would have never thought is possible or is as popular as it is now. So it kind of gives power back to the individual if you use it properly, or you could just use it as some way to numb yourself. So like, teaching your kid intention, I think, is also really, really, really important.
I think it's really, really important. And I also think, you know, let's just assume that the world stays the same. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really important to give teach this kind of high agency approach to technology. Like, some people are going to be like me. Like, I'm like on Twitter all the time. I don't think that I'm addicted. I wouldn't describe myself as addicted to Twitter. I think it's a tremendous value for me. But, you know, some people might just decide to not use social media that much. Like, they like use it a little bit or use it not at all. That's also fine. Like, what, like, how does it fit into your life? But putting all that aside, I think that social media just has to get better. Like, it's actually like, I mean, the first time that like a 14-year-old goes viral or whatever, and they get their phone blows up or their computer blows up, and they're getting 6 likes a second, and like, it is very hard to kind of contextualize that and process that and kind of, you know, like, is, and I generally think that social media, like, it's kind of tuned for virality and it's tuned for kind of passivity and repeated things, and it doesn't have to be like that. The products could be better.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. But then it's like, how do you get someone to stay on it for as long as possible, right, if you're not creating an extrinsic motivating factor? Like, if you're not doing, oh, how many followers do I have, or likes or reposts or comments and yada yada, instead of just having that more internal locus of control where it's like, no, I'm doing this because it's like art for me, or it's meaning for me, or it's my work or whatever.
Exactly. And I think it's like, the people that are really good at social media often, who I think have the right perspective on it, They're often either they're light users of it, they kind of use it casually, or they were doing their own weird thing for like 8 years on YouTube and Instagram and Twitter, and nobody cared. They had like 100 followers and like one notification a week. And then like, after a while, like, something clicked and they grew. But like, you know, they, like, it wasn't like they didn't get it too early. They didn't get the kind of like viral adjustment too early. And so they really centered themselves on like, no, I'm just producing the kinds of things that I want. And now my numbers are going up. And if you're motivated in the right way and numbers are going up, that's great. Numbers go up is not bad. Numbers grow up is good. But if kind of like the first thing that happens to you is like, oh, I can get a lot of attention for being a weirdo, or like, you know, acting a little bit slutty, or like whatever it is, like, that it can like affect your behavior. And I think parents and educators have to be aware of that. Like, that, I think the concerns are very real. I just, the apocalyptic, like, social media is bad, it's like heroin, it's like, that is not real. And it's tough as a parent. I sympathize with anybody. I be easy on yourself as a parent. If you feel like this is hard, or you're making mistakes, or you're coming down too hard, or you're being too lax, like, everybody's trying to figure this out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say, like, probably just the universal answer is to just be aware, aware and be present with your child. So if something does happen, that you can see a shift with like their emotions, their behaviors, whatever, and you can be like, hey, what's going on? We kind of talked about that the other day. We were going for a walk with our baby. We had just dropped our oldest off at school, so it was like in the morning, and someone was doing like a drop off. Like, it was very clear that they just had a sleepover, and the other parent was like dropping them off. And my husband was like, "Oh, that's so cute! Like, oh, I can't wait till they have sleepovers." And I looked at him and I was like, "They're not having sleepovers." And he goes, "So I have a cop dad, and I've seen a different side of the world than he's seen." And I was like, "They're not having sleepovers." And he's like, "Well, what do you mean?" And I was like, that's a risk I'm not willing to take. And he's like, "Well, you just have to really know the parent." And yeah. I was like, Eric, over 90% of the time, it is someone that you really know, or even worse, a family member. So like, just there's not sleepovers happening. So we had this conversation and he's like, well, I think that if you're present, then you'll see, like, if something happens, then you'll know, because they'll be acting different. They'll, you know, maybe go inward. Or and I was like, yeah, but then it's too late. Then something happens. So, like, yes, it's important to stay energetically attuned to your kid, but, like, it's also assessing certain risks. And for me, that risk is just not worth it. Like, there's just no – the benefit doesn't outweigh that risk for me.
Yeah, I mean, just on the specific topic – I mean, it's interesting. So just speaking about different risk profiles, my 3.5-year-old just had her first weekend away from us with our, like, best friends in the world, like our family friends that we've known for 20 years and that have kids the same age as ours. And she's really comfortable with them. But we went to the beach. We went to Corpus Christi 4 hours away. And then Gina and I drove back. My wife and I drove back and we left Alice there for 2 days. And, like, it was like, and she like had the time of her life, and she got sick and she threw up, and like, I don't even know all the things that happened, but like, it was like very traumatic for Gina and I, you know, who were like thinking about her 24/7, and she comes back and she's like totally fine. Right. So yeah, I mean, just on the specific topic of, I mean, I assume you're worried about like sexual assault.
Yeah. Predators. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a real, so monsters exist. Mm-hmm. Like there are monsters in the world, and you know, as rare as they are, I mean, we have 120 schools. Like, we can't pretend away. Just like statistically, like when you've got 10,000 families and thousands of teachers and 120 schools, like, we have to have policies. Like, you know, like, teachers aren't with children alone, or there are cameras in the classroom. Like, we can't. Like, I don't think that we've ever had an incident, and hopefully we never will. But like, you can't ignore the fact that, as rare and as awful as it is, like, this is a real thing. I think it's hard to know how to manage that as a parent. It's like very, most of the answers that people give you in terms of like, oh, like, we're just not worried about that. Or like, I mean, your answer also strikes me as like, you're going to, like, your child's going to get to the point where, like, you know, you're going to have to go to war with them to prevent a sleepover. And maybe that's worth it to you. And maybe it's not. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to navigate.
Mm-hmm. I don't expect it to be easy. And I'm assuming that, like, my stance is probably going to be rare. I think most parents are probably going to think that it's like not even an abundance of caution. It's probably exceeding that in some people's minds. But again, I had a cop dad. I know people that it just has gone the wrong way. So sure, statistically, it doesn't maybe happen as often as like the news and social media try to make it out. But like, just from an anecdotal level, like, I've seen, unfortunately, the monsters. And yeah, it just, like, for me, it's just, you guys can hang out, and then what are you going to be doing anyways? It's probably going to be sleeping, right? Hopefully it's just sleeping, and then you can come home and sleep. So you can go hang out as late as you'd want, and then I'll come pick you up when it's time for bed. But so far, me and my husband are at an impasse, because he is team sleepover and I am team absolutely not. So we'll see who wins once we get to that stage.
Yeah, it's interesting how, I mean, I think most parents, most sets of parents are like basically aligned, but then there's kind of specific issues on, I mean, my wife and I are very, very aligned, and like, there's still issues on which we clash, you know, in terms of like the basic, even things like sleep training and, you know, things like that. And it's always like, it's one of the most intense things to navigate. Like, as a parent,
yeah. Sleep training is an interesting one, because I feel like that's a really common impasse. I feel that usually it's the more emotional parent has like a really big aversion to the sleep training, and then the other parent who's maybe just more logical or like left brained is like, it's fine, and it's only a few nights that we have to do this until they figure it out. How do you come to a place of agreement on something? Because usually when it comes to the sleep training, a lot of people, the fear and aversion is that they're going to feel, the child's going to feel abandoned, that you're going to kind of create some kind of like distance between you and them in that relationship. The trust is going to be broken, all sorts of things. They're not going to feel supported. So like, pretty big fears. And I would say like, some of them are probably justified. So how do you get over like that impasse?
So just tactically, like, I mean, so I mean, I'm just going to give you a couple different stories. So I know a couple where it was like you said, like, you know, the dad was like, yeah, we should do sleep training. Like, they're ready. You know, they're old enough. Like, they're old enough to sleep through the night. Here's what all the research says, blah, blah, blah. And the mom was like, okay, I cerebrally understand that. and I'm not going to listen to my child cry for 45 minutes or whatever without going in there. And there's different kinds of sleep training. Like, you don't necessarily have to wait 45 minutes, but they were thinking about a kind of cold turkey approach. And the wife checked into a hotel for a weekend. That's how they handled it. Like, she kind of knew, like, she's like, no, I agree with it intellectually, but I can't make myself believe it in the moment. And so, and that's how they handled it. There's also just like, what's true here? Like, is it going to damage your child? Even if you don't think it's going to damage your child, are there trade-offs to consider? Just where are you at as parents? Like, some parents don't mind that, like, they've got a sleep sharing setup and they like it and they like snuggling with their kid and they don't mind it. Other parents like want that space. They kind of need that space. My view is, I mean, I think children do feel abandoned when they cry and nobody comes for them. And all the evidence, physiological evidence and psychological evidence suggests that they do feel abandoned. I also don't think it matters that much. Like, I don't think that they feel abandoned in such a way that like it sticks with them and kind of makes them feel traumatized. A very, very common thing, so we're sleep training our son right now, is he cries, like the cry of abandonment, when we leave him there. And we do a thing where like we wait 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes. It depends how long we'll wait before we go in there. And the next morning is fine. And that it sounds like a small thing. Like, you might think like, yeah, like he seems fine, but like there's some trauma to break into the brain. I think if your child looks up at you with like a kind of wild grin, so happy to see you in the morning, not relief, not like, oh my God, thank God, like you're finally here. That usually results in more panic crying. But he's just like, he's fine. Like, he's happy to see you. And that, I think that's the kind of thing you want to monitor as a parent and center on, like, does it affect things the next day? Mm-hmm. Is it building up a pattern of behavior or a pattern of kind of panic or clinginess or something like that? I would worry about that more than the crying in the moment.
Yeah, I agree too. It's just assessing the attachment style. So are they displaying healthy attachment afterwards, or are they kind of showing avoidant attachment or something like that? Yeah, it's really interesting with that. I feel like we are evolved and adapted to deal and process and transmute trauma, right? Like, some traumas stick, absolutely, and they probably take a lot of conscious effort to transcend and to like really heal from. But I would say, vastly speaking, we are quite literally created to be able to like to get over it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be where we're at. So I think if we're going to like say something like sleep training, in my mind, if you do it the right way with your kid, to where you're assessing them, making sure that you're not going beyond what their level is, like their challenge level is, then I don't think that that's going to be the reason that you have like a broken adult later on. I think it takes probably a lot more than that.
Yeah, I don't think so. But there are people who vehemently disagree with both of us. And, like, you got to kind of, this is one of those things that you have to decide as a parent. I mean, modern parenting it's weird. Like, the amount of attention that a child gets from their parents, often from one parent, like during the day, is unprecedented. It's just like an insane amount of undivided attention. People have fewer kids, they have less support. You get a ton of attention with their parents. But then also, like, conversely, like the amount of kind of space and privacy that parents kind of expect to need in order to be able to work and do things is also unusual and unprecedented. And so, I mean, children are getting tons of help and support and nutrition and all sorts of things that they never would have gotten in history. But also, like, people are like, yeah, like, you can go to your room and cry until you sleep. Like, that's new. Like, that, like, you know, Cave Alice, my daughter's name is Alice. Cave Alice would have had a zillion people to sleep on and would have cuddled up with whoever was there. And we're all kind of figuring out what it means for human nature that we live in the kind of world that we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point too. Our toddler is going through like a bit of a battle when it comes to sleep. So every night is a negotiation, and I don't ever want to shut it down, because I'm like, I want him to take this into the real world. Like, I want, if he wants something and someone says no, that he's like, well, how else can I get this thing? Like, maybe I can offer you something else. So we try to create like a healthy, like, respectable dynamic where he's allowed to negotiate. And sometimes I'm like, absolutely not. Like, I'm standing firm in this thing. But every night is a negotiation. And my husband's like, oh, I just want him to go to sleep and be fine and understand that he's not lonely. And I was like, he is lonely. I feel lonely if I sleep by myself and I'm an adult. Like if you're traveling and you're not here, it's harder for me to sleep. And when in history have you had someone sleep by themselves? Yeah. And like you mentioned the cave, like there would have been a whole bunch of people in there just for safety purposes. So it's not natural to sleep by yourself. And I think his feelings are totally valid.
It is. I mean, this thought occurred to me when we started sleep training our first child. She was like 6 months old. She was actually really good with sleep. She kind of sleep trained herself. Our son is a different story. But I was like, man, she's not going to sleep with someone regularly, like in the same bed as someone for like years. Like I wouldn't, like, I mean, I'm a, you know, married adult. I sleep with someone, you know, almost every night. Like it just kind of occurred to me. It's like, wow, like she's going to sleep on her own for like the next 20 years or whatever. Like that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But it is something that most of us do as children.
Yeah, I know. That's why I was like, offer that little guy some empathy, because it's not the best sleeping by yourself. Sometimes it's great, but like overall, you want someone to cuddle with, and I think that's totally normal.
And different children are totally different. Like my daughter, who is super, super extroverted, she like, I mean, the rule for her is like she just has to stay in her room. She doesn't have to go to sleep, and she like gets up and she gets books and she reads them and she enacts little plays, and she might be up for like 2 hours after we close the door. Like she does crazy things. Like we'll find her the next morning with like a whole dollhouse set up, or like she's been building with blocks. But you know, eventually she chooses to go to sleep, and we're fine with that, you know. But other children are, I mean, they would struggle, I think, to kind of play by themselves like that. So again, you just got to know your child.
Yeah, mine would not. That's not him at all. When we first transitioned him to like a regular bed, he would just sit on the edge and he was scared to even get out. He's like, I don't know what's happening here.
Aww.
Yeah, he's very sweet.
He sounds very sweet.
So when it comes to age, and there's like this really famous longitudinal study that I just became aware of. It's based out of Canada, and this psychologist, Adam Lane Smith, was talking about it recently on a podcast where there's pretty heavily correlated relationship between kids that go into daycare young and then not so favorable outcomes later on when it comes to increase in anxiety, depression, high divorce rates, like low self-esteem, low performance in a job, or like maybe no career that they're really passionate about, like just heavily correlated with not favorable outcomes in adulthood. So obviously, there's different, when you say daycare, you can't really lump everything into the same category, because where, and I've had this conversation, we had this conversation just the other day, because we're trying to figure out what we're doing with our youngest, because I feel like every time you have another baby, you're like reassessing your decisions that you made with the first one. And are we going to do this again? Where should I adjust, et cetera? So when you say daycare, I think it's really important to decipher, like, what does that mean? And I think in this study, it's one of those drop-offs where it's kind of chaotic and there are too many kids and not as many adults and no structure whatsoever. And, you know, the TV's on, the music's on, overstimulation is like the name of the game. So to me, that's what I think of when I think daycare. I don't think of a structured, quiet, intentional environment. So is there a too soon for a child to start a Montessori program? Is there like a sweet spot where you like to see them start the program? Like,
so you're going to want to make a judgment as to how, kind of how good the programs are again. But mm-hmm. I mean, you know, our children go to our schools, the schools that I help build and run. We have very, very good infant programs, and both of our children started at 3 months old.
Which is very wow. Young.
And I mean, we don't have to take that path. Like, we make enough money that we could like stay with them or hire a nanny or something like that. I actually think that this is the best thing for him, for her, for our two children. It was the best thing for her, and it is the best thing for him. It's a beautiful environment, incredibly intentional. It's a 1-to-3 ratio. There are other babies between 3 months old and 18 months old that they kind of like learn to get along and interact with one another and get interested with one another, interested in one another. It's a really good environment for moving around. I think like a lot of very young infant environments, like I think of them as like container transfer systems. It's like, okay, like we're putting the baby in the jumper and this baby is contained, and now we're putting the baby in the crib, and now we're putting the baby in their high chair to eat. And like the babies they're like put from one jail to another and they can't really move, and that's how the situation is managed. And that's not how we manage children. We give them a ton of freedom, and it's I mean, you wouldn't think that it works, but it does. Like, it's fine for there to be a nap area where some children are napping and others aren't. They figure it out, and it's not that disruptive when one child happens to crawl into the nap area. So we have this amazing system. But yeah, like, I mean, I don't know what particular longitudinal study you're referring to, but there were like 6 months ago, a year ago, a bunch of data in the US got released on kind of medium-term outcomes, and I think, for public preschool programs, because this is something that the federal government has considered forever. Like, should there, like, we've got K-12 public schools, like, should there be pre-K public schools? And some cities or some states do it, like New York has universal pre-K. And the outcomes for children that go to those preschools are pretty mixed, like in some states and in some cases worse than children who don't go to preschool. And that doesn't surprise me at all. I think that what you said is right. Like, you can't lump everything together. And if you're looking at publicly funded preschool programs that are a huge range of quality and attention and staffing ratios and things like that, would it be better for some of those children to stay at home and not get preschool? Yeah, probably it would. And probably the parents aren't in a situation where they can do that. And so it's just, there's a lot to think about there, but it doesn't surprise me that if you kind of look at it on average and aggregate, that there are big problems longitudinally with the median preschool program. So don't pick the median preschool program as a parent, pick a great one.
So when it comes to older children and high school children and public school, I guess let's start with the public school. Where do you see, like, is the biggest shortcoming? Like, what is, where do you see it failing children the most? And then why has it not been updated ever? Like, why has it, are we still doing the same thing basically from the origin?
So if you forget about public school for a second and just look at, like, traditional education, some private schools look mostly like public schools, but they, like, have slightly better facilities, or they, you know, they seem like slightly happier places. But the basic thing that they do is the same, which is, you know, there's 45-minute block classes, there's a schedule, there's a teacher in each class. The ratios are somewhere between, like, 1 in 15 in a really good case and 1 in 40 in a, you know, more typical case. I don't like that system, whether it's a public school or a private school. I don't think that it's good for children to spend 13 years of their lives, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, most of the year, a little bit more than half of the year, until they're 18, which is a crazy old time to stop doing that. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, like teenagers should be, like, doing stuff and going out. And it's like, no, they're spending, like, 8 hours a day in a fairly constrained environment. I think, I mean, the problem with it is, I mean, all the critiques of the traditional education, I think, are true. Like, it teaches you compliance. It teaches you how to be good at the game, at the system. It disconnects you from reality. There's a Paul Graham quote that's something like, look, in real life, you do very hard things. And if you do okay, like, that's great. Like, you've accomplished something. In school, you do incredibly easy things and you have to do perfectly or else you suck. Like, I mean, it's like in real life, if you get a C, it's because you're doing something real and you accomplish something. In school, if you get a C, like, it's a disaster, right? And so just the whole orientation of schools, if you've got a really smart student going through a K-12 system, like, they'll come out lazy. Like, they'll come out thinking, I don't have to try that much to skate through, and I expect all of life to be like this. If you've got a child who's, like, a little bit off the beaten path and needs to wiggle and move, like, they're going to come out thinking, like, the world is not for me and I have to fight the system and everything sucks, and they'll never have gotten the confidence that they needed to get. If you, I mean, it just doesn't really work for anyone. For a few students it does, but it's developmentally bad. It's not what children need. As to why it hasn't changed, I mean, it's a few things. So one is that I don't think that it's not like there's a general consensus as to how education should look. Like, education, it's a young field. People didn't really start thinking about education from first principles until the 1900s. Like, so it's like a 100-year-old field. And then the second issue is, like, I mean, this is where the public part of the public system comes in. It's a massive bureaucracy. It's a huge behemoth that people have now spent generations not thinking about their child's education. Like, you send them to the local public school and you don't think about it, and hopefully it's okay, and maybe you join the PTA, but you don't think that much about the education. The teachers don't think that much about the education. The superintendents don't think that much about the education. It's a big administrative bureaucracy, and it just kind of has a lot of inertia behind it, and people are okay with it. People are just used to it. There's very little impetus for change. I mean, as much as I criticize the public system, like, something like 80% of parents are happy with it. And 90% of children go to public schools. It's like, I mean, you can criticize it and you can say, oh, people are peeling off, more students are homeschooling. The public system is there and it's huge and it's fine in the sense of like none of the threats to it are existential.
Mm. Yeah. And I feel like that's probably because a lot of parents don't have an option, right? And like they're not really as involved as they'd like to be. So it's easy to say like, oh, the school's fine, when you're not really like super dug into what's actually going on.
Yeah. I mean, when you, it's hard to, it takes a lot of time and money to do something different. And it's just that disincentivizes taking responsibility or being really thoughtful about it.
So what do you do if you're in a situation where you don't, like you have Montessori lower schools, but there's no upper school? So how does that transition look like for those kids? Is it really difficult, or would you recommend them doing a pod after, or throwing them into something that's more, that looks more like a traditional public school, whether it be private or public, but you have those block classes?
I mean, I would definitely recommend doing something different just because it's better for the child. But I don't think it's like, a lot of people have the impression that if you go to alternative education or Montessori education, let's just take Montessori in particular, and then you put them into a normal school, which a lot of parents like know that they're going to have to do at some point. They can't afford it forever, or this is just what, you know, what the circumstances permit them, or for whatever reason. Is it going to be like, oh, like now they hate it and they can't get used to it, and there's this adjustment period and all the other kids think that they're weird Montessori kids? And the basic answer to that question is they're fine. I've seen it happen a million times. We have many, many, many students go into the public system or a private system that's much more structured around kindergarten or first grade or second grade or whatever the transition point is. Like, they figure it out in like a day. Like their children, they learn that it's different. And some of the things that stick with them from Montessori really, really help them. They tend to be a little bit more advanced than their peers. You get a lot of literacy and math in pre-K, way more than you typically do in kindergarten. You think of the teacher as an ally. You think of your friends as comrades. Like, it's a Montessori school tend to be a benevolent place. And so that just kind of inoculates you against a certain kind of cynicism that you could have about teachers and instructors in school. It's a good thing. But yeah, like, will the Montessori kid like follow the teacher to the board when they get out their chalk because they think that they're about to get a personalized lesson? Like, maybe for a day or two, but they'll figure it out pretty quickly.
Does it become more difficult the older that they get? So let's say they go all the way to eighth grade and then they have to go to a more traditional high school.
I mean, a lot, I think eighth grade is actually a good age to transition. Like, a lot of teenagers, here's this kind of funny perverse thing that happens to Montessori children, especially if they stay in it for longer, is that they see movies and they have friends and they're like, oh, like in Harry Potter, like they all have to like sit in desks and they've got a teacher who's yelling at them and they take tests and like, or they see like Ferris Bueller, which is, I mean, they would never see that now. That's too old for them. But you know, like they get this idea of like school is kind of interesting. Like, traditional school is this kind of like fun place where you get to go and rebel and like you get to be allied against the teachers. And a lot of children want that experience at some point. Like, if they've only been to like hippy dippy Montessori schools or whatever, and you know, they just want a bigger school. I talked to a family just this last weekend who, like, they've got a son who loves sports. He loves football. He loves basketball. Like, our high school, we have high schools. Like, they've got like 80 children, and like they're not 80 teenagers. They're not going to have big sports teams. There's going to be limited options for that. So if that's what you want, you can go. I think it's fine. Even for a child who's, for a teenager who's kind of shy about it, who's like, you know, they've had their little intimate school with alternative education for the last 13 years or however long, and now they're transitioning into high school or transitioning into college. I don't think it's that hard. I mean, for any particular child, yeah, like, teenagers' transitions are hard. But, you know, I mean, if you go to, like, I went to public school in Tennessee, pretty typical public schools. The transition from elementary school to middle school was hard for me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like the transition from middle school to high school was hard for me. Like, these were big transitions no matter what. It's like, wow, older kids, like totally different norms. People are making out in the hallways. What the F is this? You know, like, mm-hmm. Like, you got to deal with that no matter what. It's just part of growing up. And I don't think that it's especially jarring. And I think that there are tons of advantages to kind of having that alternative education early. I do not think that your attitude should be as a parent, well, they've got to go to the real world at some point, so let's start breaking their souls in early so that they don't hate it. Like, I think your attitude should be, I'm going to and give them an agency-centric education and really help them be their best self for as long as possible. And if I have to compromise at some point, so be it. But then they'll be strong and better positioned to deal with whatever compromises come their way.
Yeah, I tend to take that that perspective as well. And it's like, how do you create something that's like the best or most pristine version for them to like kind of protect all of that for as long as possible? Because unfortunately, like, they will be in the real world, but if I can control it for as long as I can and like try to instill that sense of agency, I think that's really important. I love that at the Montessori school that my son goes to, like, there's no like Mr. or Mrs. They call all the teachers by their first name. And to me, I've seen some people, because I'm in the South, so some people think that's like really disrespectful because they're not saying ma'am or sir or addressing them by like a title. And I want my sons to know that just because someone is older than you or in a perceived position of authority or power does not mean that you don't have the right to stand up for yourself, does not make you lesser than, does not mean that you can't challenge said authority. So I think it like it instills like we're all people and we all have a right to like discuss like your boundaries and what you want. And again, it goes back to agency and kind of like sovereignty, really, on a fundamental level. And for me, that's so important. And like this whole idea of respect, I think, is really like forced compliance. We just don't want to call it that. So it's like you're a little person, so you have to listen to everyone. And then that goes into adulthood, which leads to like lack of critical thinking and you just following whatever someone is telling you to do because that's what you have been trained to do since you were 3, 4, 5.
Yeah, I think that there are two very different types of authority, at least two. One is like, you have to do what I say. Children are there to be seen and not heard, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Like all that BS that I hated when I was growing up and it was mm-hmm. everywhere. But another is the authority figure has like gravitas. Like it's like they're not like demanding obedience, but they're like, you can tell that they've kind of got the air of wisdom and seriousness and you trust them. And I think that that's good. It's hard to find, but it's good. And I think that the thing that I worry about is schools that have neither, actually, like where it's like really like there's not a trusted authority figure at all. And the animals are in charge of the zoo. And like, you know, people like, I think a lot of public schools end up being like this, where it's like, they try to like, nobody really has gravitas. And so they try to crack down, but the students find ways around it. And it's kind of a scary place for students where the kind of, there's tons of behavioral issues and it's chaotic and the rules aren't enforced. And if something goes wrong, there's nobody that you can go to. I do worry about, especially in public schools and large schools, I worry about that kind of environment. But look, I basically agree with you. Like, I don't think it's good that children grow up under some form of, you know, educational or custodial authoritarianism. Like that is very bad for children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's like the difference too between like what is an act, what's a leader, like what is a healthy leader, and or some schools call them guides, right? And I think that's the idea too. It's someone that you trust has your best interest at heart, and like they're on your team, right? They want what's best for you, and that's kind of how we explain a lot of things to our son. It's when we make these decisions, it's our job to keep you safe and to do what's best for you and your body and like your mind. So when we're telling you something, it's not because we don't want you to have fun or we don't want you to explore. It's like we are quite literally protecting you in that moment. So I think there's like a huge difference between someone exudes leadership versus someone who is more of like the old school 90s parent, you know, seen not heard, listen or I'll make you listen kind of parenting, which is not what we subscribe to at all.
Yeah, I think that kind of parenting, it still exists. It's become a lot less common. And I think that in general, the pendulum has swung the other way. There are a lot of parents who don't know how to say no. Mm-hmm. And like, if you go to Target or whatever, like, I mean, you see,
guilty.
my first job as a teenager, not my first job, but the first job where I got like a paycheck and like a W-2 was at Toys R Us. Toys R Us has gone out of business for your younger listeners. It used to be like a dedicated big box toy store. And you would see a lot of really horrific, overly permissive parenting there, where like the children would scream at the parent and the parent would just kind of roll their eyes and capitulate. And then, I mean, just in my parenting, like one time I took my 3-year-old to Target and she was like, you can have one toy. She took like 20 minutes to pick a toy. And finally I was like, if you don't pick a toy, we're going to leave. And she still didn't pick a toy. She was like really pushing the limits. And I was like, okay, like we're going to go, like I've got to be somewhere. And she threw a huge screaming fit in the middle of Target, like huge, total meltdown tantrum. And the parents around me, like the withering stares of like, I mean, what they're muttering under their breath or saying to me, was just like, can you just give her the toy?
Yeah.
And it's like, no, like I'm not going to do that. But that, like, that is that kind of limit setting. It's almost like a lost art now, or it's a dying art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're trying to appease everyone around you instead of doing what's best for your child, which to me is bananas. It's like, I don't care if you don't like the scream of my child. Like you don't know the whole context of the situation, and I'm parenting the best that I possibly can in this moment.
It's hard when your child is screaming to not capitulate in public, even not in public. It's hard to not capitulate. It takes a certain.
Or just reps. We travel a lot. We've always traveled with our babies, and there's a personality type, and then also an adjustment period. So our oldest was a horrible traveler. Like, he was one of those babies that you were like, how is it possible that he is crying for the whole 4-hour flight? And he's done that before. And I was really fortunate that I had an incredible flight attendant, and she was like very understanding and like let me come into the front to like where it was noisy to try to get him to go to sleep when I'm rocking him. But all of the people around me were just horrified. It's like, well, and he was a baby at the time. So what would you like me to do? And they're like, and one lady had the audacity to say, I'm not above dosing my children. And I'm like, well,
with what, like Benadryl or something?
Yeah. And I'm like, he's 5 months old. He can die. They literally cannot have that medication yet. Like, mind your business. Sit down. And the fact that you can't control your emotional state and you're a grown adult and you expect my 5-month old to is insanity. Right. So how about you work on yourself?
It's so interesting. I mean, you see this kind of thing happen on Twitter is a good place for this, where like somebody will like express something like, you know, there'll be a tweet that's like, all I'm saying is like, you know, if I had a baby, like I just wouldn't take them out in public if they were going to cry. And then there's like, you know, 4,000 quote tweets. It's like, you hate children, and like a bunch of people defending them. And it's like this huge flame war, and you get into kind of pro and antinatalism, radicalism. But it is, I think the kind of underlying truth, or the kind of interesting thing to grapple with, is that they're just, aren't that many spaces, public spaces in modern life that like accommodate children well. Mm-mm. Like, even if children are tolerated, it's like not that, like they're kind of an afterthought, or like people put up with them, or it's unpleasant for the child and it's unpleasant for everybody around them. It's hard, man, being a parent. Like, we live in the suburbs now, but we lived in New York with our oldest from when she was born until when she was 2.5 or so. And it's like, I mean, there's a lot of things you can do. It's great to have a toddler in the city. There's a lot of good things about it. But there's a lot of things where it's like basically ruled out that you can kind of go someplace with her. And I don't like that. Like, if I were kind of designing society from first principle, I don't know exactly what all the answers are. But I just think, like, if you go to a place like, I don't know, what's a good place somewhere in Europe? Okay, Venice. This is an extreme example. Venice is a place where there are no cars. It's this idyllic Disneyland, like, historical preserve island of Italy where everything is old and all sorts of alleys and canals, and there are no cars. Like, people just gather in squares with their children of all ages, just run around and crawl around and kick soccer balls. The adults sit around and drink spritzes and Aperol and whatever. And there's just nothing like that in the U.S. where there's this kind of like integrated public commons and children are kind of welcome. Even in the suburbs, it's like rare to see like teenagers roaming around and out and about. And it's just, I mean, even rarer than when I was a kid. So I don't know exactly what's happened there, but it's not good how tucked away children are.
It does seem that it's an intentional design that we have made society very, very almost hostile to young families. Like you said, it's very much an afterthought. And it's something that you don't think about maybe primarily until you're in the thick of it with small children, but even something as simple as going to the bathroom. And you go to the bathroom and there's not a single toilet that a kid can reach until they're honestly probably like 8, 9, like, right? Like, they're going to be too small and it's going to be hard for them to aim or to get up there.
Like a sink with a stool where they can like stand at the sink. Like, how hard is it to like hold a 3-year-old up at the sink while they're like rubbing their hands under the water? It's just like, I mean, and like one in 100 bathrooms will have this like little folding stool for them to stand on. And you're like, oh my God, this is so awesome. But it's.
But like, think of how many accessible bathrooms we have, right? So we have handicap bathrooms so that people with wheelchairs can use the bathroom respectfully and with ease. And I would venture to say there are significantly more children that struggle to reach a toilet than people that are in a wheelchair that need like that specific design. I don't know the numbers and maybe I'm off, but I venture to say
there's definitely
more kids. So why are we making such a huge adjustment for a smaller group of people where we're not taking into account children at all? It just doesn't make sense to me.
There's like some sort of vicious negative cycle where it's like, well, the expectation is that you don't generally take kids places, and so people don't design for it, and because people don't design for it, then it's really hard, and so people don't want to take their kids places. And again, I don't know kind of exactly what the answer is, but there are different places. There's this Netflix show that everybody should watch at least a couple of episodes of called Old Enough. Have you heard of this?
No, I'm going to write it down though.
It's a Japanese show that's been like subtitled for Americans, and the episodes are like 10 minutes long or something. It's basically like toddlers in suburban and rural Japan, where there is a culture of like, yeah, like the 2-year-old's just going to walk half a mile to the store and buy oranges for mom and then walk back.
Mm-hmm.
And like all the cars know to stop, and the toddler like sometimes forgets things and sometimes gets lost. But the children have an insane level of independence. But the thing that enables that independence is this like massive culture-wide, totally different perspective on accommodating children and helping children and being understanding of children and being on the lookout for children that just we're so far away from that. It's hard to know how to even achieve that. In American life,
it is interesting too. If you go your whole like first however many years, let's even say just like your first whole 6 years of feeling like an inconvenience, feeling like an afterthought, feeling like you're not welcome, and you have to at least on some level think that it's possible that a part of that is going to stick with you into adulthood, and then you wonder why like we have so much anxiety, or we don't feel like we belong, or we feel like we feel like this huge disconnect. It almost seems, I don't know, I would say there's a correlation there. I would say like look at places like Japan, and is that the same, where you have maybe a society that's a lot more understanding and open and adopting to these kids versus one that's like, you're ruining my breakfast, get out of here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely matters. And it's not the only thing that matters. And it's so multifactorial that it's hard to like point to like, because this culture does it right. Like every single adult is 10% happier. It's never that clean. But it is, I mean, when Montessori in the early 1900s started making her very intentional preschool programs, she had to commission people to design child-sized furniture. It didn't exist.
Oh, wow.
It's less than 100. It's about 100 years old, the child-sized furniture. And now it's everywhere. Now, like, Fisher-Price has it, and every house has it. But like, if you kind of multiply that out, okay, there's child-sized furniture everywhere. But, like, you know, is the world welcoming to children? Not really. I mean, it's not terrible. I don't want to overstate it. But it's, like, pretty well not that welcoming to children. It's not designed for children. The kind of things that you see in a Montessori classroom are very much the exception. And not the rule. Like, you don't see that kind of thing in public spaces almost ever, at least in the US. And does that have an impact on children? Yeah, it has an impact on children. That's why Montessori designed the furniture, to make them feel welcome, to make them feel like this is a place for them where they can feel proud of it and they can take ownership of it and they're welcome and they belong. Like, children definitely don't feel that way in a lot of spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So
I had no idea. That's so neat with the furniture. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's crazy how, I mean, this is a point that I make a lot, but just how everybody kind of thinks of like, oh, education has always been this way. Like, most things in education are pretty young. They're pretty new, especially for early childhood. The idea that a child could learn how to read at 3 or 4 years old is incredible. I mean, nobody thought that for thousands of years, for hundreds of years, really, since like the 6th century BCE. You start teaching children how to read when they're 7.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very new idea that you could teach them how to read when they're 2, 3, 4 years old.
Yeah. So I guess what's the difference there? Because I think, isn't it like the Swiss model? They don't really start school till they're 7. And then what this thing I was watching was saying that this whole Western idea of having kids read early is putting a lot of stress onto them and pressure. And it's like trying to get them to like perform and compete. Whereas the more Nordic models are more lackadaisical and they don't really focus on any of that until 7.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. And there's been arguments about this for a long time, and the arguments are not resolved. Like, there's not a general consensus about it. So a lot of more progressive educators think that it's pretty inhuman to have a child start drilling on reading when they're 4 years old or 3 years old or whatever. And there's something to that. I think that there are real concerns of, like, exactly how are you doing it? Like, are you having the child sit down? Are you rewarding them with stickers? Are you punishing them if they don't do it? Are you kind of forcing them to do it the same way that I force my child to, like, take a bath even when she doesn't want to? Is that their experience of reading when they're three? If you're going to teach reading that way, I think you should wait a little bit longer. On the other hand, I mean, and this is Montessori's innovation, she basically made reading into, like, a 17-part game that children love and that they start practicing when they're two, before they even understand that they're practicing it. I mean, Montessori, like, the two-year-olds, like, learn to wash tables. And what are they doing when they're washing the table? There's a very specific motion that they use that helps them hold up their hand when they're writing a pencil, or all the puzzles have little knobs on them that require the same motion to use it. So they're building up the muscles. And then they're playing sound games. It's like rhyming games. What starts with a s? There's what starts with a g? They're learning how to isolate sounds and perception. And so by the time when they're three, they get introduced to the idea of a letter, which is in this really fun sandpaper letter that kids love to trace and they love to touch. It's like, oh yeah, like s, I already know what that sound is. And they already know how to kind of move their fingers precisely. And now they're tracing letters. It's like by the time they're four, they're just writing, and they haven't even had to drill at all, mm-hmm. even though they've had lots and lots of practice. So if you break it, and this is the genius of Montessori, is to break things down like that. If you do it like that, it is way better to learn early. Way, way better. It's just, it's easier. It's more fun. You don't have to do drills ever. Like, you never have to go through a period of, like, you know, somebody's giving you phonics cards and you're just struggling to remember them and you don't like it and you're repeating a cursive letter on a piece of paper 7,000 times and, like, you're doing it because somebody's telling you to do it. Like, you do need practice, lots and lots of repetition and practice to learn literacy, but you can do it when you're three. You can do it when you're four in a way that is very joyful and serious and fun. And if that's the way that you're learning it, it's the better way to learn it.
No, that makes a lot more sense, right? And it goes back to not everything deserves to be lumped into the same category. So, mm-hmm, yeah, that makes sense. Before we wrap up, is there, like, one piece of advice that you would give to parents that are trying to figure out what to do with education for their child, or they kind of feel like they're at an impasse?
What to do with what with their child? Sorry.
Like, as far as education. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so in terms of schooling and education, the thing that I would say is you should evaluate specific teachers and classrooms, like the ones that are available to you in your vicinity. Like, I mean, it's easy for me to sit here and say Montessori is the best, and I do think that Montessori is the best, and I do think that it matters. I've dedicated my life to it. And the traditional system is awful, and I do think that the traditional system is awful. But when it comes down to it, if you've got, like, a six-year-old or a nine-year-old and you've just moved or whatever, and you're looking at your options, it's not the school or the philosophy that they're going to be with. It's all of that channeled through a specific teacher and a specific classroom environment. And if you can find one great teacher that you think that your child will connect with, that will really get your child, that has gravitas, that will really teach, excite them and challenge them and do all the things that you want them to do in education, like, nothing else matters in the system, really. I mean, other things do matter, but that is the most important thing to find. And that's the hardest thing to find. So, I mean, I would even say this is true of Montessori classrooms. Like, what classroom is your child going to be in? Go and look at it and observe, mm-hmm. and think, picture your child there. And you know, how will they do? Like, you know, what will they love it? What kind of child do you have? Do you have a child that needs something a little bit more warm and fuzzy? Or do you have a child that needs something a little bit more structured? Like, really evaluate the specifics. In terms of parenting, the one piece of parenting advice that I always give, so maybe this can be the last thing that I say, is, and this is a kind of core Montessori principle. If your child is focused on something, not like zoned out in front of the TV or video games, but like they're doing something actively, like with their hands, they're engaged, don't interrupt it. Just let them be. Don't go in and, I mean, it's so tempting as a parent to, like, comment or to get excited or to go and play with your child or whatever. Like, I mean, when I'm training babysitters, I say, like, when my child is, like, really into something, what do you do? And the babysitter naturally says, like, oh, I would play with her. I would engage with her. I would talk to her. I would encourage her. I would be like, no, you get out your phone and you doom scroll, Like, don't mess with my child when they're concentrating. Just leave her be. And like, it's very counterintuitive, but that is how concentration builds. And that is that kind of like independent engagement, that capacity for persistence, for sticking with it, for ignoring distractions, for like really being into something. Like, that is what most people don't have. And it starts in early childhood, and you don't want to mess with it.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I'm going to take that. I didn't know that, because that would be my reflex as well. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, of course.
Awesome. Before we take off, can you tell the listeners where they can follow you and how they can support you, any projects, all of that good stuff?
Sure. I may have mentioned earlier that I am on Twitter a lot. That's the best way to follow me. I'm at M Bateman, B-A-T-E-M-A-N, on Twitter. My organization, it's like one of these umbrella organizations with a lot of sub-organizations. We've got a training center, we've got a high school. The main thing to follow is Guidepost Montessori. So if you want to look up our schools, it's Guidepost Montessori, and the website is guidepostmontessori.com. And from there, you can get to our homeschooling resources or our school locations or the many, many, many things that we do. So yeah, those are the two main things.
Awesome. And I will link all of that below for everyone. Thank you so much, Matt. This was amazing. It was a pleasure having you on.
No, thank you so much, Candace. It was a pleasure being here.
And that's it for this week's episode of Chatting with Candace. If you enjoyed the content, please leave a 5-star review, share it with a friend, share it on your social media. Word of mouth is the best way for a podcast to grow. And let me know what your favorite part was, anything that you agreed with, disagreed with, something that you learned. Put it in the comments below, and I'll see you next week. Bye, everybody.